We are delighted indeed to welcome you, Jim. And first of all, you know, we'd like to start with your great-grandfather started a real estate business way back in, when was it,
1891, yeah. He emigrated as a teenager in 1874 from Kenny-Kerry, just outside of the town of Kenmare, and he actually got his first job in Scranton working as a gopher on a construction site. He didn't have any trade other than, you know, he grew up on a farm, and he didn't have a higher education. He was walking past the job site and had heard a bunch of guys speaking in Irish, and he said, "Can I come in and help?" And they said, "Sure, come on in." And he started off basically, you know, getting water and more lumber and nails, and they actually taught him the carpentry trade. So that now he had a skill, so he was able to go out and start his own carpentry business. And, you know, in those days, everybody worked 6 days a week, and he saved his money and then started buying lots. And then when he sold some lots for a big profit because of the, they started laying the tracks in the Bronx, and he had bought land where he thought the train stations were going to be, he had the money to be able to start building his own buildings. So he started that business, and then my grandfather, James, and a bunch of his brothers all graduated, first-generation Americans, all graduated from Hatton College of Engineering. One of them actually also went to Columbia Law School and got a law degree, and they all worked in the family business, building apartment buildings and commercial properties, et cetera, and also single-family homes, and predominantly in the Woodlawn section of the Bronx and the Wakefield section, which is across the Bronx River, yeah, on the easterly side of the Bronx River. And a lot of those buildings still stand, so it was a great story.
Now, and of course, the tradition continues with the Houlihans.
Yep.
I want to ask you about your involvement, and indeed for that matter, your wife, Pat, in all things Irish, but in particular, I'd like to talk about the Great Hunger Memorial in of Westchester, in Westchester County.
Yeah, my wife, Pat, and I actually met through work. She started working as a executive assistant for me, and we worked together for a couple of years, and then all of a sudden we became a dating couple and eventually got married. Pat had worked originally in her early 20s, I think for about 10 years at the Irish Tourist Board, and had all the Irish connections. Her parents were both born in Ireland, and in any event, when this idea came about that we should build a hunger memorial in Westchester, there were several people who volunteered to basically run the committee, and then for one reason or other decided they weren't up to the task or had other things to do. So I was approached with the concept that either we're going to disband the committee or we want you to take it over and get this thing going. And Pat was there all the way with me and gave a lot of good advice, a keen insight into all the divergent personalities within the Irish community. And we built something that we were very proud of. It won the New York Times Art Critic Award for the best new work of public art when it was dedicated in 2001, and it's in a beautiful park alongside the Somme River Parkway in Hartley.
It's lovely. It's really, yeah. It's great, and it's, was it that 2001? Jeez, no wonder we're getting
time flies when you're having fun.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
But it is, and indeed, if we go back to that period, you know, there, the Ireland's Great Hunger, then there wasn't a great amount of acknowledgement or admissions or, you know, memorials. But around that time, there was a very keen awareness, and I do know that you know, from my own experience with the Irish Hunger Memorial at Battery Park City.
Which is terrific, too.
It absolutely. That had sprung into such great hunger memorials right across the United States and, of course, for North America in Canada as well. Let me ask you about Westchester in general. Westchester, it's as someone would those of us in New York anyway consider Westchester to be, you know, the fifth borough. It's it's really a very progressive county, and you know, for those a lot of people who live there say, well, you know, you get away from the hubbub of New York City, and yet we're close enough to New York City to make it a great place to work and
to
live.
It's a perfect combination. You know, I live in Bronxville and raised my kids here, and Pat and I are in the city all the time, but from Bronxville to Grand Central Station in rush hour is 23 minutes, the express.
Mm.
And when it slows down in off-peak and you're on odd hours, it's still under 40 minutes to Grand Central. You know, driving is dependent on New York City traffic. We live right off the entrance to the highway, so if I go into the city for business or for entertainment or to visit my grandkids, without traffic, I get to Midtown in 25 minutes.
Okay.
But that's a big if. Sometimes it could take 2 hours.
Yeah, tell us about it. Okay,
yeah.
If we go any further now, our listeners will be running up there too.
Right.
You know, tongue in cheek there. Let me ask you about your interest and your chairmanship of the Great Hunger Memorial Committee at the Fighting Irishman celebration of the Celtic Warrior. How did that get off the ground?
Well, you know, I guess I'm like a lot of Irish Americans. My mother's parents were from Ireland. My father's family had already been here for a couple of generations. So I had a great influence by my maternal grandmother and grandfather who lived across the street from us. So they were our chief babysitter also when I was growing up. So we would learn the Irish songs and about Irish history. And also whenever they babysat us, we had to say the five decades of the rosary. But then came the special intentions, which I think were always longer than the five decades. Mm-hmm. But that gave us a sense of Irishness. And, of course, all the Irish relatives coming by, and, you know, I would say, like, well, how is that person related to us? And so he or she is a cousin, which really wasn't a cousin, but there was someone who would come by and might be staying for a couple of weeks till they found a job or an apartment or whatever. And so that was certainly handed down. But I will be honest with you. I went through a period as a teenager and as a young adult where I really wasn't interested and thought it was a little corny or whatever. And, you know, that concept that we should all be in a melting pot and lose our ethnic identity was popular at the time. But what I got drawn back into things Irish was through Irish music. And I love music, all kinds of music. I play the piano. But through the songs, I started playing on the piano and listening to on the radio and buying CDs, and, well, in those days, records. They still had records. But, you know, I would get interested in, well, what's this song about? What's the story about? And that got me into reading books about Irish history, et cetera. And that was really the key that opened the door for me and got me really interested and involved. And, of course, The Great Hunger, I remember buying on a remainder table a book by Thomas Kinnelly about the Great Hunger. And I remember reading the book and actually crying as I was reading the book. And I had I had heard about it, but didn't really know any of the details. And it was such a tragic period, and so many people were thrown by the wayside and not given proper treatment, fair shake, whatever. Irish people were treated as second-class citizens in their own country because they were Irish and because they were Catholic. And unfortunately, those days are behind us, but it was a horrific thing. And, you know, I think it left a scar on the Irish psyche, especially for those in Ireland. You know, but it also, you know, there's a cause and effect. So it pushed so many people into leaving, and they went and became very successful in other countries where they had, you know, doors of opportunity open to them that weren't open at that time in Ireland, and not just in the United States, but in England, in Europe, Australia, Canada, et cetera.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like wherever you go over the world, you run into Irish people, and they're all out working and happy and still celebrating their Irishness. And so we benefited, the side effect of a terrible thing the world benefited from, I think.
Yes. Christine Keneally, who is, indeed, she is the founder and continues, the Ireland's Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac University, indeed, which is indeed home of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum. She had and continues to write great Irish historical books that bring us before, during, and after, you know, the Irish famine, some hair-raising facts that somehow we none of us were, you know, privy to before that.
Yeah, I read her book, The Great Calamity, and I just realized the author I misspoke, it wasn't Thomas Keneally, it was Thomas Gallagher, and Christine Keneally was the second book I read about The Great Hunger, and I actually have had the pleasure to meet and speak with Christine over the years, and, you know, John Lay did a great job of shepherding that museum while he was president of Quinnipiac, and I actually had the pleasure of going up there and doing a private tour and having lunch with John, and it's a really a special place.
Yeah, too bad that that the new broom that swept clean there didn't indeed continue that. But anyway, that's a story for another day.
Yes.
Let us talk about some of the organizations and in your own philanthropic manner and those, you know, who have supported areas like Fordham, Fordham University, you know, Fordham Prep. You have a slew of them, Fairfield University, and you're also and have been, you know, supporters of the Irish Repertory Theatre, the Irish Arts Centre. There are a great number of people in Westchester who might be, you know, considered to be, well, for the lack of a better a phrase, you know, well healed in the sense that and among the great number of those who support Irish causes, you find them in Westchester. There are groups and there are some, might say, cliques that indeed do a lot of great charitable work, and that continues at a time when everybody is saying that the Irish, they're losing, you know, their identity in the Great American Dream, which I think was not true to begin with.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that, you know, it could be true for some people. And, you know, when you make generalities, there's always exceptions. But I think a lot of people, and not just in Westchester, but all over the world, are proud of their ancestral heritage. People go back to Ireland. I mean, one of the things that my wife Pat and I have done is we just came back in June from our 10th group trip to Ireland, which started in, I believe, 1994, and we had 75 people with us. That would be friends, family, business associates, maybe even a couple enemies. But we had two coaches, and each time we go to different places. But this time we were in Dublin, and then we were up in Cavan. And, you know, of course, people said, why are you going to Cavan? And I said, because it's a beautiful county, and we stayed at the Farnham, Lord Farnham Estate, and we had a great time there and used the spa and got people play golf. But the people got to see part of Ireland they might not ordinarily see if they just went to, say, Dublin and Galway, et cetera. Of course, when we were in Dublin, we did go to the Guinness Storehouse, but we also had tours of Kilmainham Jail, which is one of the most moving things. Forget about Irish, one of the most moving things I've ever gone through in my entire life. And so we have this great tour operator, Seamus Buckley from Cork, who's been taking us around the last 10 years or so. He's very informative, and he usually gets another great coach driver, tour guide.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I know a bit about, so I sit usually in the tour guide seat next to Seamus, and we swap stories and talk about Irish history and Irish geography, and we put the music on and then a couple Irish jokes.
Yeah.
And so it's a great thing, and people have a great time, and they learn a little bit, and then they always want to know, when are we going on the next trip? And I said, give me a little time to recover from the last one.
Yeah, the clan, you know, the clan gatherings in Ireland have obviously, they have, you know, they've really taken off over
yes.
the last again. Well, decade and even before that, it
sure.
Seems like it's a great place. Anyway, I think Anya has counted the number of commercials that you slipped in there, which brings us, you know, to some of your other involvements. The Francis Pope Foundation, it was organized originally founded by singer Mary O'Dowd.
And she's still running it.
And she is still running it after
yeah.
all of these years. But it's, indeed, it was a novel idea at the time
mm-hmm.
In terms of drawing attention to another aspect and something that's not necessarily Irish, but some of us have indeed
yeah.
been touched by it in the sense that, you know, particularly with children and the scourge, you know, of terminal cancer, which, you know, and if we go back some 20 years ago, kids with terminal cancer, that's what it was. There was no hope of their ever surviving. But regardless of, say, insurance or support for the parents, for the families.
Well, the whole family, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, fortunately, I have not gone through a horrific thing like that. I can't imagine how difficult it must be for not just the child who's suffering, but the parents and the siblings and the larger family, grandparents, et cetera. So what the Francis Pope Foundation does is raises at this dinner where Pat is one of the co-honorees with Des O'Brien on March 6th at the Pierre Hotel, and we're very proud of that fact. I'm busy getting people to come and support it. But it provides money for families in need, whether it be transportation. Let's say you have a child that has to go to Sloan Kettering and you don't live in New York,
mm-hmm.
so they help with transportation. They help with temporary lodging, you know, rental or whatever. And, you know, this is, you know, at a time when you have to go through something like that, to have people there to help you and support you and take care of things and simplify things is God's
yeah.
work, you know.
And it also, in addition to the real need for financial support, it also it shows a support level on a community and supportive you know, personal level for those who...
Yes, absolutely.
And, but, you know, that, again, it's the Francis Pope Foundation, and let me... I'm trying to get a website here for...
There's a website where you can go on and get information about it. And if you're interested in learning more about the foundation or attending the event, which I said is March 6th at the Pierre Hotel, or supporting it financially, you know, and we'd be very receptive to that. If we're fortunate, maybe we'll get Mary O'Dowd to sing that night. She's a real treasure. But it's all volunteers, and as I said,
raised significant money too, and it's great. I want to come back though to something, of course, that in your family, apart from your business and the great charitable work that your family and of course all of a great circle of supporters there in Westchester, but Monsignor Jim Murray, your mother's brother, was indeed one of, not only was he a tremendous man of the cloth priest, but he was the one who indeed came to the fore in starting the Project Irish Outreach at Catholic Charities, and indeed which subsequently would have been run by Trish O'Callaghan, who had spent decades there at the helm. That was indeed something that, and your uncle, fondly known as Buddy, was a tremendous influence. As head of Catholic Charities, he had, that was a huge title again, and responsibility. He was appointed by Cardinal O'Connor of old. But one of the aspects of that, and one of the first collaborations was, of course, linking Our Lady of Mercy Hospital in the Bronx to Our Lady's Hospital for Sick Children in Dublin, in Ireland. And it gave, it was a tremendous starting point in the sense that now you had not too well-known Dublin hospital that indeed had done a pile of research that indeed had a wealth of information which indeed now could be shared with initially Our Lady of Mercy Hospital here in the Bronx, but then spread out from there. What a tremendous, you know, project that was. And something that, I, you know, and I was around through that and saw how effective that was. And, of course, with the passage of time, we know the influence that had.
Well, you know, he was a very special human being. You said he was a man of the cloth, but he was a great man. Who happened to be a priest. You know, he had gone to first in his family to go to get a college degree from Fordham University, and then was for a short while in Europe at the end of World War II, and then came back and finished his studies and went to Fordham Law School and practiced for a short time thereafter until he decided he had a vocation. So he entered the seminary late in life at 26. He wasn't ordained until he was 32. And then when he started working, I think his first assignment was down on the Bowery. And the Archdiocese said, we want you to go back to Fordham and get a doctoral in social work. not a doctoral, sorry, a master's in social work from Fordham, because we have plans for you in the future. So he had 3 degrees from Fordham. He was a brilliant man, and he was a doer. So many things he did were through inspiration. For instance, the first AIDS hostel that the Catholic Charities ever had was his idea. It was created on Christopher Street in Greenwich Village during the scourge, the AIDS scourge, HIV scourge. And, you know, he would see a problem and try to address it. He was very, very involved, as you know, in all things about legalizing the undocumented Irish.
Yeah,
he was very involved in the peace process. I think he made over 60 trips to Ireland, Northern Ireland, which led to the, you know, a number of people, but he was part of that team that led to the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think about all the things he accomplished, is an amazing thing. And he was a humble person. He's brilliant but humble, which you don't find that often. He had a lot of friends, including Governor Carey and Mayor Koch and Adrian Flannelly. but he was just a people's person. And, you know, he always said his prayers from his breviary every night. And I have his breviary as the one thing I took from his apartment. And in it, he had this prayer, which he said every night. And the prayer was about others and about dedicating his life to others, which is exactly what he did. I mean, if he had gone into business, he could have run a Fortune 500 company and been a millionaire many times over. But he chose a life of service, and he did it so well, so excellently. And so many people benefited from his good works. I remember, you know, when he was buried from St. Patrick's Cathedral, I was amazed by the amount of people who were there from all walks of life, including the guy who owned the Aperitivo restaurant, took the train in from Montauk because it was important for him to get up early and be there that morning for the funeral, because he had been not only a friend, but he recognized how special a person he was. And he affected so many people that way. So he inspired others. And, you know, part of my accomplishments, or whatever you want to call them, has a deep root in him, because he set the example. He set the tone. And watching what he did, you know, you can learn a lot by watching. And watching my grandparents, watching, for instance, we talked about charity before. My parents never turned – anyone came to the door selling Girl Scout cookies or chances or whatever. My parents never said no, and they never preached, but I sat there and watched, and I said, you know what, that's the way to go through life. Be generous. You know, if you have something, share it. And yeah, he was certainly, you know, a great proponent of
all
that.
All of that. And,
he still lives. You know, I don't know – if there's going to be a life hereafter. I've never died, and I've never
been there.
But I will tell you this, that I think that he still lives, because I still think of him all the time, and I still use him as an inspiration and as a kind of a centering rock. And he had the effect not just on our family, but on so many friends like you and people who worked at Catholic Charities. He was really a special, special man.
Jim Houlihan, again, I know that it has to be a tremendous honor, and many would say overdue, to be selected as Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day parade in Westchester County in White Plains.
Yes.
You are indeed. You have a very select group of aides there, but I want to, again, just let people know, it's the White Plains St. Patrick's Day Parade, and the installation actually is taking place this coming Thursday.
That's correct. The Vintage in White Plains. It's a bar restaurant on Main Street on Thursday night, and we're planning on having beautiful weather on March 14th. A soft, fine day, as they say in Ireland, and the parade kicks off at 12, and it's a big celebration. This is their 23rd annual parade. They do a very good job, and you know, I don't know that it's so much overdue. I think I just finally got mature enough to be considered.
Okay. Now, humility has no place in this program here.
I suppose so.
Again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Good luck. And if you're getting, you know, if you're putting in a bid there for the good weather, I would hope that you would be generous enough in White Plains to spread it out, not only to Westchester County, but to the rest of us. Jim Holland, good luck to you again.
Thank you so much, Adrian.
And okay.
Okay.
Then, thank you.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And happy St. Patrick's season to you and to Pat. And friends, you are listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. It's time for us to wrap up.